All right, hello and welcome everyone to the first Global Tipping Points of 2019, as well as the first World Affairs Council of New Hampshire event of the year. We're so excited that you've taken the time to come out and hear from the Union of Concerned Scientists about such an important topic of nuclear issues, which are seemingly becoming more and more important with the suspension of the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty between the U.S. and Russia that recently occurred. So I'm really interested to get Dr. Grunlund's views on that. So my name is Tim Horgan. I'm the Executive Director of the World Affairs Council of New Hampshire. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to provide the public with up-to-date and accurate information about global issues in a nonpartisan way. Our not-for-profit status allows us to leverage the community's support to bring you events such as this, which help create a more globally aware citizenship and build strong community of people who are engaged in the world around them. We also work to make New Hampshire a more global place through our International Visitor Leadership Program, which brings around 275 international visitors to the state each year. This program helps to create lasting relationships with up-and-coming leaders from around the world to help build peace and security and positive relationships with different countries. We also work with high school education programs, and next month we'll be hosting our fifth annual Academic World Quest at Southern New Hampshire University, where teams will compete in a global trivia challenge for the opportunity to go down to Washington, D.C. and compete in the national competition down there. We're really excited about that program this year, in that the team that wins in D.C. gets a trip to an all-expenses-paid trip to Qatar for 15 days. And the second-place team in New Hampshire will get academic scholarships to a Model G20 summit down in Mexico City. They just recently changed their cities. So we're really excited that we'll be providing those opportunities for international travel for several students, and we hope that our teams do well and have the opportunity to go on these great trips. So I know you're thinking to yourself, wow, they do so many great things. I don't know how they do it all. Well, in all honesty, we really can't do it without the support of our members, our sponsors, and our donors. Without the support, the generous support of those people, we would not be able to bring great programs like this and our upcoming programs to the state of New Hampshire. So I want to take a moment to thank particularly our members and our donors. I could go through all of the names, but I have a feeling you guys don't want to sit through that. So, but I will thank specifically our two sponsors for tonight's event, the Union of Concerned Scientists, who have graciously helped out with some of the funding for this program, as well as UNH Manchester, who provides us with the space, as well as some of the financial resources that are required to run this program. To those of you who are here that are not yet members, I know we have some in the crowd, we do please ask that you consider joining the organization to really help us continue our great work and bring the programs that you enjoy so much to the state. We're a small not-for-profit organization, and we try and leverage every dollar that we have to maximize its value to our members and to our supporters. I also want to take a moment to mention a little bit of sad news, in that at the end of the month, we will unfortunately be losing our great events coordinator, Carly Miller. She's been with us for about a year and a half, and she's been instrumental in getting all of these wonderful programs set up and run for us. So we'll definitely be missing her, but I know she has some great things ahead of her. So thank you, Carly, for all your help over the past year and a half. Okay, one final thing to note is that, as I've mentioned, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, so the thoughts and views of our speakers are theirs alone. We are here to provide a platform for people to discuss various topics, and we want to get out as much information as possible on the pressing international issues of the day, but we do not take a stance on whether or not what they're saying is right or wrong. That is up for you to decide. All right, so enough about us. We'll move on to tonight's event. We're so happy to have the Union of Concerned Scientists here to talk about nuclear nonproliferation and the challenges of the current international situation. It's particularly pertinent due to the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that was recently suspended, and that will be playing a big role in the conversation tonight, I'm sure. From the Union of Concerned Scientists, we have Dr. Lisbeth Grönlund. She is a senior scientist and the co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Her work focuses on technical and policy issues related to nuclear weapons, ballistic missile defense systems, and space weapons, with an emphasis on changing U.S. policy on these issues. She has a PhD in theoretical physics from Cornell University. Thank you so much, Dr. Grönlund, for joining us. I'm quite excited to hear what you have to say.
Okay, thank you so much. I think there might even be some UCS members in the crowd, I hope so. Thanks for coming. So I hear all this, I'm getting email about the weather, and nothing seems to be happening out there, so I hope that continues to be the case. Is there a way to turn the lights down up here? Okay, well, while they're doing that, I was here. Nope, I was here. 2 years ago, speaking on this very subject, we didn't really know much about what President Trump was planning to do. I had some speculation, but now we know. So let's move ahead. So I'm going to look at the question of what did President Trump inherit? He didn't start from zero. And what is he doing with it? So briefly, I'm going to go through the arsenal and what the current status is and where we're going. U.S.-Russian arms control, which is very pertinent, as you just said, the INF Treaty, first Trump and then Russia. Okay, now you're all in the dark. That's fine.
Back on.
All right, and then I'm going to talk about U.S. nuclear weapons policy with particular emphasis on when the U.S. Might use nuclear weapons first. Okay, so let's talk about the arsenal. We're going to start with the current status. So the U.S. has long-range so-called strategic weapons, and people refer to it as the triad. It's very Pentagon-esque. And the legs, so there are three legs. In total, there are roughly 2,000 of these. And the first leg are the land-based Minuteman III ballistic missiles. Now, what is a ballistic missile? It's basically a baseball, okay? You throw it as fast as you can, and it then proceeds under the influence of gravity and air resistance. That's all it is. Same thing with a rocket booster. Basically, the booster gets that warhead going as fast as it can, and then it's off, and all it's doing is falling. So there are two kinds of warheads on these missiles. We have 400 of the missiles, and one warhead has a yield of 300 kilotons, which is a kiloton is 1,000 tons of TNT. So it's big, and the other one, 335. Okay, so the second leg of the triad is our submarine-based Trident, also ballistic missiles. And again, there are two kinds of warheads. One with a yield of 100 and the other with 455 kilotons. This is a photo of a test off the Florida coast. They test these missiles routinely. Okay, so the third leg is the so-called air-based leg, which includes bombs and air-launched cruise missiles, which is not the same as a ballistic missile. A cruise missile is more like an airplane, okay? It is the motor is going the whole time, okay? So it's able to maneuver, whereas a ballistic missile, once you let go of that baseball, it's just gonna, there's no changing its trajectory at that point. Okay, so we have a so-called stealth bomber. And right here, it's dropping a B-61 bomb. And that bomb has variable yields ranging from 0.3 kilotons, which is about 2% of the explosive power of the weapon that destroyed Hiroshima. So it's small, I mean, relatively speaking. And then the other options are 5, 10, or 50. This is the cruise missile. It has also different yields that go between 5 and 150 kilotons. All right, so those are the deployed so-called strategic weapons. All right, we also have tactical weapons. And the difference is that they are short, they're delivered by short-range aircraft. Okay, it's the same bomb, in fact. We have the B-61 bomb. But it is not, it will not be delivered by a long-range aircraft. So we have 150 of these in Europe, U.S. air bases in 5 countries. Although there's a little, they haven't said anything, but there are people who speculate that they may have been removed from Turkey. What? That they may have been removed from Turkey. Oh, I realize I'm not really. And as I said before, it has variable yields, starting with a very low one. And here it is being dropped by an aircraft of the type you'd have in Europe. Okay, so we have now deployed strategic and deployed tactical. And then we have a lot of weapons that are not deployed, they're in reserve. Okay, and this is a storage facility for some of those bombs. All right, so that's where we are. Let's see where we're going. So I actually criticize Democrats and Republicans and anybody else, okay, because none of their policies have been good. So Obama came up with a plan that over the next 30 years, the U.S. would replace everything. The submarines, the missiles, the weapons, the bombers, with new versions that would be, have more military oomph. And the cost of this 30-year plan is $1.2 trillion. Okay, so that's what Trump inherited. Okay, where does he go with that? He adds two new kinds of weapons. All right, the first one is a submarine-launched cruise missile. Remember, the ones we have now on subs are ballistic missiles. We used to have a sub-launched cruise missile, and it was put in storage in 1991 after the Cold War ended. Bush Sr. said he took all the weapons off of U.S. Ships. So it has been in storage. It was in storage starting in 1991. The Navy decided eventually they didn't actually want it. They had no need for it. They didn't want it. They wanted to retire it. But other people in the Pentagon didn't agree, and they finally agreed. Obama finally said, enough is enough. And so it was retired and dismantled. The last one was dismantled in 2013. So it's gone. It's gone because the Navy didn't want it, and there was no need for it. So Trump wants a new one. It'll take decades for this to happen. Okay, so, they might just start with a study of what the options are, and then they would have to develop it, and then they'd have to build them and test. So it takes a while. All right. On the other hand, I went backwards. The second kind of new weapon he wants to build can happen very quickly before his term is up. So he wants to build a low-yield version of the warheads that are on our Trident submarines. You might remember the ones we have now. There's one that has 100 kilotons and one that has 455. And so this one would have 6.5 kilotons. So you don't have to build a missile or anything for it. You're going to take one of the existing warheads out and pop that one in. And so why? Okay, why are they doing this? Well, they say that they needed to fill an existing low yield gap. That's not my term, that's their term. So Russia will not think that it could use low yield weapons without a response from the US. So let's look at the gap. So this is a table of all US weapons, deployed weapons, and their explosive power. So does this have a pointer on it, laser pointer?
No.
Okay. All right, so I'm just gonna use the old fashioned way. So this is the biggest one, obviously. It's a megaton. Down at the other end, it's blown up, and you can see that it goes down to 0.3. As I said, that's about 2% of the Hiroshima power. And this is sketched in here as roughly Hiroshima power. Now, oh yeah, I'm sorry. I really need a clip-on.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, okay. So you can see here on the low end, end of the spectrum, we have 0.3, we have 1.5, we have 5, and we have 10. And there is kind of a gap there that, so the 6.5 kind of nicely fills that gap, right? It's absurd. It's absurd. You know, to suggest that Russia would look at the blue lines and say, aha! I'm going to use nuclear weapons because you don't have one that's 6.5 kilotons. It's nonsense. But it's happening. It's happening quickly because it doesn't take much effort. It doesn't cost much money. And it could happen by the time at the end of Trump's term. The Navy is not keen on this. This is not what they want. And the Navy usually gets its way. But it's not happening in this case. All right. Okay, now let's talk about U.S. Russian arms control. So the INF Treaty is the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. It actually doesn't eliminate nuclear weapons, okay? It eliminates certain missiles. Okay, so by intermediate, so it's short and medium range, okay, and they have defined that to be between 500 and 5,500 kilometers, 300 to 3,400 miles, okay? And so any missile, whether it's ballistic or cruise, in that range, you cannot have if it's ground-based. You can have them on ships or submarines or in the air, but not ground-based. Doesn't matter what the warhead, you just can't have any, whether or not they were armed with conventional weapons or not. So this was signed by Reagan and Gorbachev a long time ago in 1987. And because of it, the US destroyed about 850 missiles and Soviet Union about 1900. So it had a real concrete effect. So on February 1st, the U.S. gave its six-month notice that it was going to leave the treaty. Trump cited Russian cheating and constraints on U.S. weapons, which is, of course, the point of an arms control treaty. So he doesn't want constraints on weapons. There have been, for several years, the U.S. has been accusing Russia of cheating. And the accusations are in relation to one particular cruise missile, I think it's a cruise missile, where they have been testing it at a range above 500 kilometers. So it's definitely in the zone there that they're not allowed to test. Russia has been complaining about a U.S. A missile, it's not a missile, but it's a launcher system that could be used to launch a missile. And there is a mechanism for working these things out. There's a committee. There's a kind of a, at the end of the treaty, it specifies, if you have a problem, here's what you do. And the U.S. has not been willing to do that. So the neither country, well, certainly the U.S. is really not taken the steps it would if it wanted to preserve the treaty. And Russia, you know, basically 5 days after Trump pulled out, they said, okay, fine, we're going to pull out too. And here we go. It's off to the races. I mean, the U.S., the Pentagon wants to be able to build a whole slew of these missiles. It's interested in having them in Asia. And, you know, so, and the U.S. has the money to do this. Russia, not so much. You know, they're not, they don't have the Pentagon budget that we do. So it's going to be interesting to see what actually happens on the ground, so to speak. But one thing that's clear is that this is not helping relations, okay? And I'll say a little bit more about that later. So the other agreement that we have with Russia is called the New START Agreement, signed pretty recently by Obama and Medvedev in 2010. It had to be ratified by the Senate, obviously, and it had a nice bunch of people, including 13 Republicans. It was not, and this was a very partisan era. I mean, maybe not as much as it is now, but even then. So getting 13 Republicans was also necessary because you need two-thirds to ratify a treaty. So it reduced, it only talked about deployed strategic. Remember, there are these categories. Deployed strategic, which are the triad. Deployed tactical, which are the bombs in Europe. And those in storage. Doesn't do anything about storage. Doesn't do anything about tactical. Only talks about the deployed weapons, and we have roughly 2,000. So and that may seem at odds with the 1550 there. There's a little asterisk. So for each warhead on a silo-based missile or submarine-based missile, each one counts for one. But if you have 20 bombs on a bomber, it counts for one as well. They only count the bombers. So the 1550 is a little squishy, and it's more like maybe 1750, 1800. But both countries have met that limit and are abiding by it. The treaty expires in 2021, just after a new president could be taking office. At that point, you can extend it for another 5 years. So that's what's, you know, written into it. And so this just shows you where, you know, how this is sort of the end point. Well, it's not the end point, but this is where the U.S. and Russian arsenals have gone from the very beginning. The U.S. is blue. You can see down there at the far left that it has weapons before Russia does, Soviet Union does. And then it goes up and up and up. So at a peak, the U.S. had about 33,000, and Russia 45,000. It was really pretty crazy. And now we're down to about 4. And this includes, this must include, let's see, 2017. This must include the ones in storage. So what about New START? Okay, so Trump and Putin had a phone call shortly after he took office. And during that phone call, Putin said, well, you know what? We should think about extending that treaty. And Trump said that the treaty favored Russia as one of several bad deals negotiated by the Obama administration, which in and of itself, you know, even if it, no matter how wonderful the treaty was, I think Trump is quite motivated by undoing things that Obama did. So so that may be really the essence of the problem, but the Pentagon loves New START, okay? They love New START. On the big side, here's the Air Force General, who is commander of U.S. Strategic Command, namely all the nuclear weapons. And he says, I'm a big supporter of the treaty when it comes to nuclear weapons and nuclear capabilities. Bilateral, verifiable arms control agreements are essential to our ability to provide an effective deterrent. You know, these treaties, there is a lot of verification. We find out a lot of stuff about what Russia's doing and vice versa. And the military feels like that is a good deal. Okay, they don't want to get rid of this treaty. But as you know, the Pentagon does not have a lot of sway over President Trump at this point. You know, Mattis, I think, did for some time, but obviously he's left. Who knows? I'm not optimistic that he won't leave. Now, as I was saying, it's not just, when you have a treaty, it's not just that you limit a certain kind of weapon, which in and of itself is good. There are other less tangible benefits. And this was true throughout the Cold War. Okay, the US and Soviet Union didn't interact on a lot of things, but they talked about nuclear weapons and arms control. Okay, and there were scientists and diplomats who respected each other who were doing those negotiations. And so it really helped stability between those two countries. And it wasn't just during the negotiations that these folks interacted, because there was verification, because there were things that kept going. It required an ongoing interactions with peers in the other country. And it also reassures other countries. I mean, the rest of the world was looking at the Soviet-U.S. arms race in horror. And it gave them some confidence that things were not completely out of control. Now, conversely, when you leave treaties, it's not good for the relationship. It's not, you know, other countries are looking maybe with horror again. And, you know, this is a time, leaving aside the Trump, Russia, whatever was going on, the U.S. and Russia are not in good shape, okay? We don't have a very good relationship right now. And Congress is very angry at Russia. So there is the potential for Congress to support and the U.S. to take actions against Russia just because they're angry. Okay, and so this sort of adds to that milieu where we're not acting in our own self-interest because we want to stick it to Russia. Did you have a question or a comment? So it's a bad thing that Trump announced that we would leave in 6 months. And I had actually thought and hoped that our European allies might persuade him otherwise, but it does not seem to be the case. All right, let's talk about policy. So we have all these weapons, and what do we do with them? Okay, how do we think about using them? How do we operate them? And so I'm going to start talking about hair trigger, alert, and launch on warning. If the U.S. has sensors that allow it to detect the launch of a ballistic missile basically anywhere in the world. So let's just say Russia launches a ballistic missile. This is actually a U.S. missile launch from a test range. I don't have any photos of it. As I said, we have satellites and we have radars, and we're able to pick up that launch in a matter of minutes, which is also how we know when North Korea launches and other people launch, other countries launch. And then it goes to a centralized computer and the clock starts ticking. So this, for a long time, well, I guess still now, but especially in the height of the Cold War, there was a concern that Russia would launch its nuclear armed missiles at the U.S. nuclear armed missiles and disarm us. And so to deal with that, they set up a system where if there was warning of an incoming attack, you would go first. So you would basically, rather than have those missiles destroyed, you would send your missiles out. It relied on this warning system, okay? And I said the clock starts ticking because it takes about 25 minutes for a missile, a ballistic missile, to go from the U.S. to Russia and vice versa. Okay, so you don't have much time. And so after the warning, the data comes in from the satellites and the radars and goes to the computer. If there's something that looks bad, it goes to, you know, the Pentagon officials who look at it and go, okay, this is real. We need to talk to the president because only the president can authorize the use of nuclear weapons. And when they reach the president, they will say, at least so far, sir, you know, we have an incoming attack. We recommend one of these five options, or we recommend this option. And by the time that is all done, there is 10 minutes for the president to be briefed and to make this decision. And because you need to reach the president at all times, he has an officer next to him carrying what's called a nuclear football, which is that black briefcase. And in it is the giant Chinese menu. Not really Chinese, a giant menu that lists all the options. So when the Pentagon says, we think it should be number 12, then the president can turn and to page 12 and see what that is. And it has, you know, a communication system so that they can reach the president at all times. And they're not hiding this for several reasons. They want Russia to know that we have this. So what happens if the president says go? The order goes to the people. These are the folks in the underground command centers that would launch the silo-based missiles. It would go out to the pilots, would go out to the submarine forces. And it all sounds great, except there have been lots of near misses. Okay, this is a system that is under tremendous time pressure, involves humans and machines that can go wrong. And things have gone wrong. I mean, nothing to the point where the U.S. has launched anything or Russia has launched anything. So there was an incident, the training tape incident in the U.S. There's this, I think you've seen photos of it, that giant room with all of the big screens, and then, you know, rows and rows of military folks. And oh my goodness, it looked like a full-on Soviet attack. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It looked like the kind of thing they practiced dealing with all the time. And it was, because somebody had accidentally put in a training tape. And they figured this out, you know, early enough, but, you know, a minor mistake led to that. There was an incident in the Soviet Union, which has been told in a film called The Man Who Saved the World. I don't know how many of you have seen it. So Stanislav Petrov was in the Soviet facility watching the data. And it looked like there was an incoming attack of a hand, not very many, but a handful of U.S. Missiles that could have been, you know, kind of a precursor attack. And protocol, you know, everything checked out, all the sensors checked out, and under protocol, he was supposed to tell his supervisor, and he didn't. And it turned out that the Russian satellites were observing glint from clouds. There was no attack. And he kind of went with his gut. And he was fired, or maybe just demoted. These things had, you know, things are not infallible, especially complicated equipment. And then there was the sounding rocket incident. So this was when Yeltsin was president of Russia. The Russian radars detected what looked like several submarine-launched missiles off the coast which is the kind of thing the U.S. might do if it was trying to knock out Russia's sensors so that it could then launch a larger attack. What they really picked up was the signal of a Norwegian experimental scientific rocket. But the early flight of both of those things looked the same. And, you know, when you do that kind of experiments, you send the information out, and, you know, somehow Norwegians, you know, they didn't, you know, the people in Russia didn't get the information. And so, you know, they thought that this could be real, and it went up, apparently, to Yeltsin, who said no. But, you know, and these are the ones we know about. I am sure there are things we do not know about. A new wrinkle is cyber attack. Okay, so this gentleman here was the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, and he points out that in some respects the situation was better during the Cold War because cyber attack is a new wild card in the deck. And he's right. So there are two options for dealing with this. One is to take these missiles as off alert, to take, you know, to basically not have the capability to push the button and have them, you know, go quickly. And there are various ways you could do that, and we can talk about them in more. I forgot to ask how long I should talk for. I'm probably, you could just get rid of them. You know, do we need the three legs of the triad? What's interesting is that before he became Secretary of Defense, I can see this is out of date, because she's a former Secretary of Defense. He says, is it time to reduce the triad to a dyad, removing the land-based missiles? This would reduce the false alarm danger. So I actually think eventually we'll get there. Eventually being, many years. But, you know, that's the timescale in which I remain hopeful. It's not the next 6 months. All right, so let's talk about, very briefly, the president's authority to order a nuclear launch. As I said before, only the president can order a launch, and the president doesn't need any to consult with anybody. It's their prerogative. And the reason it's structured that way is back in the first days of the Cold War, the government was worried that they would not be able to get approval from the president. So they did not want, you know, they didn't want to complicate anything by having anybody else involved if are required to be involved. So they were more worried about being able to go than being able to not go if it was not a good idea. So they set the system up that way. So in a striking example of just how dangerous this is. So in 74, Nixon said, I could go back into my office and pick up the telephone, and in 25 minutes, 70 million people would be dead. Now, he said this to a journalist. Now, during Watergate, he was not a happy camper. He was really unstable. He was drinking heavily. And Secretary of Defense Schlesinger told the Joint Chiefs of Staff, any order coming from the president, such as a nuclear launch order, should go through him or Secretary of State Henry Kissinger first. Now that is flat out illegal for him to do that. But it was a good thing. And ultimately no order came. But that's the problem. You can see that there is no systematic control over this kind of thing. And so I think I'm going to move on to, we have developed a sort of a scheme to add some people to the, who are required to issue a go order. And we do that. It turns out that FEMA
keeps track of who is president. That is their main thing. Okay, so they know where the president is at all times, and they know if the president is down, then the president becomes Pence. And immediately assumes the responsibilities of the president and already has a football. Okay, and then it goes down from there. If something happens to Pence, it goes to the Speaker of the House. If I have this, let's see. Right, and on down the line, and I don't know how far down the line people have a football, but it goes down the line in case something happens to people at the top. Because as you go down, that person is then the president. And they are the only ones who can order an attack. And the U.S. is very concerned that they have that ability at all times. Okay, they don't want an incentive for Russia to kill the president because then the U.S., you know, couldn't use his nuclear weapons. So this is something that the government takes very, very seriously. So when there is an occasion, for example, a State of the Union address, when all these folks are expected to be there, somebody at kind of the lower level is the designated survivor, and they are taken somewhere with a football that they will only have access to if all the people above them are killed or, you know, maimed and unable to take on responsibility. So the U.S. is really very, very, very serious about this. And because it knows the locations of these people at all times, is able to communicate with them at all times, you can throw in some more people, right? It used to be you don't have to just reach the president at all. You could simultaneously reach the president and say the top two people in the chain. And then there could be, the president could say, I want to do X, but it only goes forward if the others agree. So there's a way, a pretty straightforward way to implement this. People often say, well, you can't do that because there's no time. Well, if you have time to reach the president, you have time to reach the others. Anyway, something for a discussion. So what I really, really want to talk about is using nuclear weapons first. So the U.S. has always reserved the right to use nuclear weapons first, and in fact, as you know, did so during World War II. And in the first few decades, there was no policy, really, at all. And during the Cold War, it had up to, at one point, 7,000 of these short-range tactical weapons in Europe to respond if there had been a Soviet conventional attack, conventional invasion, and they range from nuclear howitzers to short-range, you know, missiles to bombs. I mean, everything was nuclear. During the Korean and Vietnam Wars and the two Taiwan Strait crises, it considered using nuclear weapons, even though none of these countries had weapons of their own. So this sort of Wild West came to kind of an end when the U.S. and, well, when the world was trying to negotiate the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the goal of which is to get all those countries that didn't have nuclear weapons to say they never would. And it occurred to the weapon states that maybe if they, you know, continue to threaten their use against countries without nuclear weapons, that would not be an incentive for them to join the treaty. They might decide, well, I'm just going to hold on to my nuclear option because maybe that's all I have to, you know, prevent one of these countries from attacking me. And so the non-nuclear states failed. They wanted it in the treaty and they failed to get it in the treaty. What happened is that the five nuclear armed countries, and this is the U.S., Soviet Union, China, Britain, and France, indicated their general opposition to using nuclear weapons against non-nuclear countries in a Security Council resolution. A little wishy-washy. All right, so Carter finally says something formal. He issues what's called a negative security assurance, which is a statement about what you won't do, and he says, we will not use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon state in compliance with the treaty, except in response to an attack on the U.S., its troops, allies, by a non-nuclear state, ally to a nuclear weapon state or associated with a nuclear weapon state. And this is in reference to all the countries that were in the Warsaw Pact, because they were allied with the Soviet Union. Now, this is only in reference to using nuclear weapons against countries without them. Okay, it doesn't say anything about what we may or may not do against nuclear-armed states. All right, so, and then we get Bush. Bush does not, he doesn't say anything public in, you know, refuting the Carter policy. In fact, he doesn't say anything public at all. And he produces, as all administrations have done since then, a nuclear posture review, which was secret and leaked. And he lists as targets Russia and China, okay, they're nuclear weapon states, North Korea, which had not become a nuclear weapon state at the time this was listed, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Libya. No nuclear weapons at all, okay? And not allied with a nuclear weapon state. And why and when might they do that? In response to a biological, chemical, or conventional attack, also in the event of surprising military developments, pretty much anything could, you know, could lead the U.S. to use nuclear weapons in a non-nuclear weapon state. Okay. Now we have Obama. Okay, Obama goes one better than Carter. He gets rid of that, well, he should, right? The Warsaw Pact just did. He gets rid of that clause and simply says, the U.S. will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states in compliance with the NPT. Just straightforward. Excellent. Excellent. But there's a little but. That we might change this policy if bioweapons become a bigger threat. So it's a little bit like, this is our policy until we say it isn't. And so what about countries with nuclear weapons? So the only countries, there are 9 countries in the world with nuclear weapons. They're all our allies, except for Russia, China, and North Korea. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. So the U.S. might use nuclear weapons against 3 countries. First, against 3 countries, Russia, China, and North Korea, okay? So since these countries have weapons, so it would decide to deliberately start a nuclear war, it would use nuclear weapons first, but obviously they can retaliate, but only in extreme circumstances to defend its vital interests. It's unclear what that means. But Obama did set out as a goal a no first use policy, a policy saying the U.S. will not use nuclear weapons first, period. And during the last months of his presidency, he wanted to do this, and he was talked out of it by Secretary of State John Kerry, Secretary of Energy Ernie Moniz, and Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, who argued that our allies, who are under the so-called nuclear umbrella, might not be happy about this, and we needed to talk to them a lot more. So I don't, you know, at best the clock ran out. All right, so now what does Trump do? Okay, he keeps that negative security assurance flat out. He will not use nuclear weapons against countries, except he has a disclaimer as well, which is expanded. Okay, under Obama, it was bioweapons. This is very vague. If non-nuclear strategic attack technology, so maybe it's cyber weapons, maybe it's, who knows, right? Anything new might cause the U.S. to reverse that policy, okay? He also retains the Obama policy about attacking nuclear weapon states only to defend its vital interests, but then he clarifies what extreme circumstances are, because these are non-nuclear attacks on U.S. or allied population or infrastructure. Infrastructure you know, a water plant, I mean, you know, it could be a kind of smallish thing. U.S. or allied nuclear forces, command and control, warning and attack, assessment capabilities, so that could be a radar. So it was very, very broad that, you know, that he would, that the U.S. would consider using nuclear weapons first against those three countries. Okay, the other thing Trump does, I mean, again, this is not new. He just ups the game a little bit. As the Nuclear Posture Review explicitly says, this is the document he put out years ago, for a regional conflict, nuclear war fighting refers to using nuclear weapons in an ongoing way once a conventional conflict has expanded to include nuclear weapons. So, what are we planning to do? Well, we're going to strengthen the integration of our nuclear and non-nuclear military planning. We are going to plan, train, and exercise to integrate U.S. nuclear and non-nuclear forces to operate in the face of adversary nuclear threats and employment. In other words, we are going to integrate our nuclear and conventional forces in Europe, it's really about Europe, so that we can fight if nuclear weapons have been used. It sounds like nuclear war fighting to me, but, okay, the U.S., you know, they say, no, it's not intended to enable, it does not enable nuclear war fighting, which I think is sort of alternative facts. So maybe that's what the U.S. thinks, but certainly Russia and China will view it that way. And the exercises themselves, I mean, these are not, you know, it's not in a basement. They actually have, aircraft. And exercise in Europe with hardware. This is not a computer exercise. You know, Russia knows that's going on. And it deliberately blurs the line between nuclear and conventional forces. Really what you want is a really clear fire break, and this just does away with it. All right, so where are we? Oh, I'm going backwards again. So I have told you some not happy news. On the positive side of the ledger, we don't have a lot, but there is a growing interest in trying to get the U.S. to adopt a no-first use policy. As I said, Obama came close. There is a resolution introduced by Adam Smith in the House, and recently a companion piece by Senator Warren in the Senate. It simply says, it is the policy of the United States to not use nuclear weapons first. There are no asterisks, there are no, we might change our mind later. None of the people from New Hampshire have co-sponsored these things. What's really interesting is Warren, of course, is a leading candidate for president. Senator Gillibrand, who was recently in town, a lot of traffic in New Hampshire from these folks, also said she supported a no-first-use policy and just signed on as a co-sponsor to Warren's legislation. This is actually really hopeful, okay? That, I mean, it's a clearly understood policy. You don't have to get into the weeds. And there is now a growing political interest in this. And New Hampshire has two roles to play. One, you gotta get your people on. And two, as I said, the presidential candidates are gonna be coming through here, and you ought to be out there raising your hand, say, oh, you know, what do you think about no first use? You know, it seems to me like it's a good idea. You guys need to get out there and go. And thank you.
We do have microphones, so please wait for Dr. Berlin to call on you and wait for the microphone so that everybody can hear the question.
I'm going to go over here.
That policy that you just talked about with Senator Warren.
Yes.
And Smith proposed.
Yeah.
Binding on the president.
Well, no.
Am I still on?
All of these policies are the province of the administration. So, so it would have been Obama who declared a no first use policy. It would be the president to take missiles off hair trigger alert. So it's not binding, or at least I think if there would be an enormous legal fight. it is political pressure is what it is. Okay, that's what it is. We want the next president to know about this, to care about it, to think that this is something that people out here care about, and to do it. But they're not just going to dream this up themselves. So this is a form of political pressure. In the back there.
I'm sure you know, but I wanted to
Did you, the person in the back?
Sorry. Okay. I can't tell.
Oh.
If it requires a two-thirds majority of the Senate to pass these treaties, why can Trump unilaterally, or any president unilaterally, back out of the treaty?
Yeah, that's the rule.
I mean, it just did. I don't, you know, that's what can happen. That's what can happen. The Senate doesn't have a say in whether or not, I mean, they can jump up and down, they can, you know, have a lot of pressure, but they don't get a vote on that. You had something, though.
Sorry to have interrupted. I just wanted to point out for everybody's interest that right this minute in the New Hampshire House, there's a continuing resolution, HCR 7,
yes,
against first use. And since they only heard it today, if you email the committee members, you could establish your position with that committee. And I think it's called state and federal government or something like that. It's in the House. So if you look at the New Hampshire government website, you can find it.
Yeah. We've actually been doing some work on that. And where's Roger? Do you want to stand up and say something about that?
About the resolution?
Yeah, and the hearing and...
There was a hearing today, and my colleague, Jake Bosch, did testify in favor of the resolution. Several other members did as well. And a couple of questions did come up of note. One was the question of no first use and deterrence. That's something perhaps you could elaborate on. And then what is the definition of a low yield weapon? Is nuclear, is it really low yield at all?
Right.
So Jake did report that it was a positive hearing. There wasn't any real animosity towards it at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But the one in the front is absolutely right. It is HR 7. It's HCR 7, and it is in the State and Federal Affairs Committee. The hearing was today. You can always go to the General Court website, and every Thursday, 5 o'clock, the House and Senate post their calendars for the upcoming week, and you can look at what is anticipated for House and Senate action in that following week. So you can always get a head start and see if the bill is coming up again for consideration. If the next step is to exec it out, have deliberation, and that committee will either vote pass it on to the full House, or pass it on to the full House with any decision that is inexpedient to legislate. In either case, the House will have a say on the bill.
So let me just address this question of no first use and deterrence. So folks who want to retain the option of using nuclear weapons first believe say that it would, for example, deter Russia from using cyber weapons against the U.S., or that it would deter
North Korea from using chemical weapons against South Korea. And that if we didn't have that threat of responding with nuclear weapons, that they might just do that. The U.S. has, by far, the world's most capable, largest military force that is, we have 100 plus bases around the world. So there is a lot of so-called deterrent capability right there. If North Korea did attack South Korea with chemical weapons, it would be foolhardy to start a nuclear, because if we then attack them with a nuclear weapon, you can guess what they're gonna do. And there are lots and lots of other options, right? We have conventional weapons that could target their chemical production facility or what have you. So it's at best a double-edged sword. I don't actually think, there's not a clear, there's a presumption, of course, when you talk about deterrence, about what the other country is thinking and might do. There's a lot of assumptions, and to assume that a country would not be deterred by all of the other forces that we have, but somehow would be because we might use nuclear weapons, even though they have their own nuclear weapons, right? We're only talking about those three countries: China, Russia, and North Korea. That's it. That's the whole thing. And so somehow to suggest that our threat of using nuclear weapons first will stop them from doing anything instead of starting a nuclear war, I think it's just silly. It's very silly. And in terms of deterring a nuclear attack, which is not what it's not what No First Use is about, right? If you have nuclear forces and Russia decides to attack us with nuclear weapons, then No First Use has nothing to say, right? Of course we can't respond. So it's really a very limited set of circumstances that people are actually talking about, right? Which is Russia, China, or North Korea decide to use something other than a nuclear weapon, that they will somehow be deterred from doing it because we might use a nuclear weapon against them. Okay. Yes.
I think we have to remember that just as there are strategic and tactical weapon systems, there are strategic and tactical nuclear plants.
Nuclear what?
Nuclear plants. What we are talking about, there is an open discussion of things that is going on. We try to plan things. To understand unexpected results that come out of our plans. But then we have the tactical side, which is the president, and we've had one. And you can probably understand why the president would not let this be a strategic, but keep it as a tactical. The president wouldn't be reelected, the press would be furious, we would be wimps.
Yeah.
The president, which I really believe, had a "we will absorb the first nuclear attack without retaliation." That was the plan of this country. The plan was our plan.
In the dark. People up there in the dark.
I'm just curious, do you have a sense of the dimensions of the Chinese nuclear arsenal?
Yes. It has more than a few dozen, probably 50 or 60, long-range ballistic missiles that could reach the U.S. They have shorter-range missiles that could reach closer in. They have an arsenal, a couple hundred weapons. What's interesting is they keep, for their long range missiles, they keep the warheads separate from the missile. So they can't launch on warning.
nor do they have a warning system. I mean, you know, the whole, you know, you need the satellites and the radars, they don't have that either. So if they did decide to use nuclear weapons, it would take hours at best, So that's kind of interesting. Yes.
I apologize for two, but probably brief questions. One is, in the big nuclear arsenal, are there multiple warheads on some of the missiles that we have to keep in mention, whether herbs or whatever are counted as single weapons or not? And the other thing, getting back to the intermediate range missiles and weapons, they would, if they were going to be targeting Russia or China, they would have to be based in countries that are closer to those, to them. And would there be some opposition in those countries to make themselves a target by having U.S. missiles on their territory?
Right, so I missed the first part of the second question. You said that if we had...
If we wanted to deploy intermediate range missiles
With nuclear weapons.
With nuclear weapons, yeah. Could strike Russia or China. Have to be in
Yes, it would. And that would be. So let me start with the second one first. So South Korea and Japan would be the logical places to put weapons. And in fact, for many, many years, the U.S. had nuclear weapons in South Korea. They pulled them out in the 90s. Well, Japan's constitution would prohibit it. There was a lot of secret shenanigans between the U.S. and Japanese government that went on for years, where the U.S. brought nuclear weapons on its boats into harbor, and you know, which is also not permitted, and the Japanese government lied to the population. That's all come out now. It would not be politically feasible to put those weapons in. But the U.S. has no, it wants short-range conventional missiles. And it has no need for short-range nuclear missiles because it has long-range missiles. So in terms of, so some of the missiles the U.S. has can carry just one warhead, and some can carry a lot. So the land-based missiles, there's one kind of warhead is small enough that you can put three on top. But we don't. We only put one, but we could add two. Okay, we only put one because of arms control. The other one is big enough, or too big, and there's just one. On the submarine-based missiles, one of the warheads is really small, and there were 12 of those on a missile. How many there were the other ones? But also for arms control, we have reduced that number. So on average, on the submarines, it's probably 5-ish warheads on each missile. So, answer your question.
So,
yeah.
For treaty purposes, you said that multiple bombs in a bomber counts as one.
Yeah.
With multiple bombs on
No, no. They have ways to verify that. So No, they don't. They're not like bombers.
Okay.
They're counted.
I think we've reached our time. So thank you so much for coming out tonight, and thank you to Dr. Berlin for her wonderful presentation.
Thank you. Okay, remember to contact your representatives and get them to co-sponsor the Adam Smith Senator Warren bill.
Okay, just a few quick announcements before you guys head out. I want to make a reminder that our next Global Tipping Points is with Dr. Melinda Gonzalez, who's in the back here, talking about social movements in Turkey. That'll be on March 4th. I will also let people know that our first Crossroads Film Series program, which is scheduled for February 27th, is now currently sold out. We are in the largest room we can find there, so. But we are going to be showing the movie again in Portsmouth in the fall. We're just about to announce that series, so if you missed out on this one, be sure that you register for the one in Portsmouth this fall.
Waitlist!
There's also a waitlist, and we will be checking in with people just before the before the event to make sure that those people who have said they are coming are actually coming. That also is a good reminder that for our two other films that we'll be showing in March and April, that we are getting a lot of interest in those already as well. So please do, if you want to see those movies, sign up quickly to make sure that you do have a seat. We will try and make sure we can accommodate as many people as possible. So thank you so much for coming out tonight, and we look forward to seeing you soon. Right. Yeah. No.